This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Wealthy donors will be able to give as much money as they want to political candidates and campaigns after a Supreme Court decision yesterday. President Obama says the Affordable Care Act is working, and he made a stop in Michigan yesterday, calling again for a minimum wage increase. And House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan is pitching his latest spending plan. It's expected to generate campaign themes for both sides of the aisle. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to talk politics. You can join the conversation. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. And Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Howard.
And we're hearing Ken clearer than we ever have, thanks to the internet.
Yeah. Well, wait, you mean I'm not sitting in the same room with you?
No.
Well, you usually start off with a trivia question, and I think you said this one has a little something to do with baseball.
Well, I know that, first of all, Cincinnati Reds, I read somewhere that they went 17 innings getting shut out to open the season, which is the first time that it's a franchise record for the Reds.
Yes.
And the Yankees have lost two straight to the Houston Astros, which I checked. Maybe the first time in history they've ever lost two in a row to the Houston Astros. I think it's also the only time they've ever played the Houston Astros. But if we're talking about losing, and since we're talking about baseball, So what contemporary politician from Ohio has lost five races?
Contemporary politician from Ohio that has lost five races.
Okay.
Howard's got his thinking cap on.
We'll think about that for a little while.
And if you think you know the answer to that, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. A contemporary Ohio politician that's lost five races in a row, correct?
Not in a row. Actually, three in a row, then one and one, but five, yeah, total.
Okay, there you go. 513-419-7100. While we're waiting for some folks to take a guess at that, let's talk about yesterday's Supreme Court case on campaign contributions. Sounds like a pretty major decision, and it's going to have a whole lot of political ramifications.
It is huge, and it's not so much that you can give more money than you can than you've been doing in the past to the same politician. You still have a limit. You could only still give $5,200 to a candidate, $2,600 in the primary, $2,600 in the general election each cycle. But unlike in the past, where you had a limit to how much you could spend, we could only spend $48,600 to all federal candidates combined. Now there is no limit. If you want to spend $5,200 for every Republican or every Democrat running for Congress in the country, go for it. You can do it. The Supreme Court has removed that limitation.
There was some pretty strong wording. I stole these off Facebook yesterday from a quote from Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion. Quote, if the First Amendment protects flag burning, funeral protest, and Nazi parades, despite the profound offense such spectacles cause, it surely protects political campaign speech despite popular opposition, end quote on that one. And then speaking against yesterday's decision, Justice Breyer said, quote, today's decision eviscerates our nation's campaign finance laws, leaving a remnant incapable of dealing with the grave problems of democratic legitimacy that those laws were intended to resolve. And actually, Justice Breyer actually addressed the opinion from the bench, which is rare.
Yeah.
Is very rare. And basically, that has set up the two opposing sides on the campaign finance issue. The first side, expressed by Chief Justice Roberts, basically is saying that money is free speech. And what Justice Breyer said basically is money is power and money is undue influence. So the two sides about whether there's enough money or too much money in politics, you heard that from both the Roberts and Breyer's decisions.
You know, one of the first things I thought about was Sheldon Adelson, the big casino mogul who spent so much money, and he had this cattle call of presidential candidates in Las Vegas last weekend. What's this going to do for guys like him? I mean,
Well, we know how much power and how much influence they have already. They were already calling it the Adelson primary,
right?
Because, you know, Chris Christie and John Kasich and other would-be presidential nominees in 2016 flocked. It was ostensibly the Republican-Jewish coalition,
right,
in Las Vegas. It wasn't really at Sheldon Adelson's house, but it just may as well have been.
It was at his hotel.
Well, it was at his hotel, right, the Venetian.
Right.
I have a bumper sticker I gave to the Venetian blind, which is, you know, is long, but yeah. He has a lot of influence, but think of what he did in 2012. Remember, for the longest time, he was spending a fortune on Newt Gingrich when everybody on the planet Earth knew that Newt Gingrich was not going to be the nominee, and yet Adelson spent tons and tons of money,
right,
until he finally said, what am I doing? And he went to Mitt Romney. So the influence on the ultimate result, I'm not sure, but again, when you have so much money like that, people pay attention.
Who benefits from this the most? I mean, is this other than the political consultants, we're going to have a whole lot more of other people's money to spend?
Well, you know, the political parties do as well, because
right
now, because of the Citizens United decision in 2010, political PACs, these independent, so-called independent PACs, that says basically corporations and unions can spend whatever they want on these political PACs. The PACs seem to hurt now. I think the PACs will be hurt by this decision, because now it goes to the actual candidates, the actual political parties who get the money themselves. Because now, in addition to removing the limit on how much I can spend on all federal candidates, it also removes the limit on how much I can spend to party committees. And right now that limit was $74,600, which I always spend every year on party committees. But now there's no limit. So the good news, if you're worried about politics, and I mean, I'm sorry, if you're worried about the influence of money on politics, the good news is that perhaps with all this, with the change here, the anonymity of who's giving what to where will be decreased, because when you're giving to an actual candidate, you have to know, we have to know who these people are. But ultimately, there'll be much, much more money. Not that there's enough money, not that there's not enough money now in politics, but there'll be much more money in the campaign, certainly starting in 2014.
And the same applies to the political parties. You'll know who is actually giving this money to them.
Right, and the political parties were ultimately not big fans of these anonymous 501c political action committees, because the political parties would love to take the money and spend it as they wish, not these independent groups doing it.
There was a quote from an attorney this morning in a piece on Morning Edition that was talking about these wealthy donors, and I think his quote was that their wallets will be rattling, because even for high-end donors, this means that they're going to get hit up for a lot more funds that they could politely say, well, I can't because there's a cap.
Right. That's exactly, there's a lot of truth to that. The old argument was that, well, I'd love to give to your campaign, but I'm maxed out. Maxed out meaning by the federal law is limited to how much I can spend. Now that there is no more, this guy named Max doesn't exist anymore. So, of course, these wealthy givers, these wealthy donors will be hit up for more and more money. And sometimes, you know, eventually at some point you have to say no, and it's going to be tough to say no when there are no limits.
And perhaps the case is already pending, and I'm not just aware of it, but how long is it before the next case is filed to take away the limit on how much you can contribute to each candidate?
Well, that's what Justice Clarence Thomas says. She says there should be no limits at all. Now, Justice Roberts specifically said that limit on how much you can give to a particular candidate is not going away, is not affected by the McCutcheon decision. But for all we know, given what happened in 2010 with Citizens United, given what happened yesterday with the McCutcheon decision, that could be the next step. Right now, they're just throwing out limits on campaign money. I was going to say left and right, but probably right and right, because most money goes to the Republican Party.
Again, we're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and he put out a trivia question. Do your trivia question one more time. We'll see if we can get an answer for it.
Well, we're talking about the not great start by the Reds and the Yankees in 2014, and it's, you know, the Yankees are already 0-2, and I think we should fire Ralph Houk or whoever the manager is. I don't know. I mean, you know how Yankee fans are so
just
impatient.
For the record, we're 1-1 right now. Okay.
I know you're 1-1. You had a walk off yesterday. Well, we're 0-2, and right now Yankee fans are slitting their wrists because they're 0-2, and you can't have that. Well, so if we're talking about losing, then of course we're talking about Ohio politicians. Well, when I talk about Ohio not losing, but in Ohio political history, contemporary political history. Tell me somebody who has lost five races in his political career. In fact, the first three were losses.
All right, 513-419-7100. And we have Christopher on the line from Lebanon. Go ahead with your guess.
Good afternoon. Mike DeWine.
Mike DeWine.
Mike DeWine is not the answer. He did lose for the Senate, but of course, I think that's the only loss he has. He lost twice for the Senate. He lost, I guess, against John Glenn.
Right.
And then he lost for re-election to Sherrod Brown. But that's two losses, not five.
All right, Christopher, we appreciate your guess. And let's try Tony in Saddamsville. Go ahead with your guess.
Said Howard Metzenbaum.
Howard Metzenbaum was defeated in 1970. In 1970 when he lost to Bob Taft for the Senate. He lost in 1974 when he was beaten by John Glenn in the primary. But that's just two losses.
All right.
Okay.
Tony, we appreciate your guess. If you think you know the answer, 513-419-7100. And I think Howard has a guess written down here, so we'll see if he's right. What the president was in Michigan yesterday talking about raising the minimum wage. I think there was some reporting this morning that the Senate may actually vote to do that next week, but it's likely going nowhere in the House. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
They look at this as a potential campaign issue this fall, the Democrats and the president.
Everything that's on, basically everything that comes to the House or Senate floor is a political document. Because we know that repealing Obamacare in the House is not going to happen. We know that passing a $10.10 minimum wage bill in the Senate is not going to go anywhere. But basically, each side wants to tweak the other side. And the Democrats, who have been on the defensive for so long on the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, we see a lot of Democrats are saying, okay, let's change the conversation. Let's talk about pocketbook issues. Let's talk about increasing the minimum wage. Let's talk about pay equity between men and women. So while the Republicans are very happy to say, look, Obamacare is the issue, and you defend this to your political doom, Democrats say, well, we're going to counter with these pocketbook issues. So both sides think they could be on the offensive with these arguments.
We're talking politics today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we will be continuing our conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Political junkie Ken Rudin is joining us today for our monthly chat about politics, and you can join the conversation. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Working on a trivia question, an Ohio politician who has lost five races, a contemporary politician. We have lots of folks lined up now to take a stab at that, and let's try Rob in Felicity. Go ahead, Rob.
I'm going to guess Dennis Kucinich.
Ken?
Pardon me?
That's a good question. I know he's lost. He lost at least two for the House.
Presidential.
And he has lost for president, although it's kind of hard to say that he wasn't the nominee. And he did lose for mayor to George Voinovich, but I count three losses for Dennis Voinovich. Dennis Kucinich. So I don't think he has the five. He's pretty close to it, but I think he has three losses.
All right.
Thanks, Rob. Let's try Dave.
That's
Dave, go ahead.
Good guess.
Okay. I'm an out-of-stater, so I'm gonna guess Kasich. And then I'm gonna take an exception to your baseball. The Reds. They've only scored one in 17 innings, right?
Right.
But they've only killed
For the first 17. Right. For the first 17, they were shut out.
Yeah, but they've only given up one run in 18.
But so. You're also shut out with the John King. Yeah, right. Well,
yes, you're definitely shut out with Kasich.
All right, we've got Rob in Blue Eyes.
John Kasich actually has never
I think we're having trouble with Ken's connection here. Ken, are you back?
Ken, you there?
Ken, yeah, John Kasich, I don't think he's... Oh.
His line is cutting out on us. Rob from Blue Ash, have you got a guess?
Yeah, hi. Is it Thomas Kindness?
Ken, Thomas Kindness?
Kindness.
Thomas Kindness, that's not a bad guess, but no, it's not Thomas Kindness. He did run for the Senate and lose to John Glenn. He also sought a comeback for the House, and he lost to a guy named John Boehner for that very famous Buzz Lukens primary in 1990. We don't talk enough about Buzz Lukens on the show. I don't know why. Anyway, so it's not Thomas Kindness.
I covered his trial, so we don't want to talk about Buzz Lukens.
And let's see, we've got one more person lined up here. Mary Lou from Springboro. Mary Lou, what's your guess?
Well, I'm wondering if it could be Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland.
Mary Lou is the correct answer.
Absolutely.
She's the correct answer. Ted Strickland was the...
Alumni classmate, not classmate, but a little bit older than I am.
Was he a loser back then? was Ted a loser back then when you knew him?
Loser?
No, I'm teasing. But anyway.
I'm teasing. And I don't know what all.
Was this back in Duck Run?
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, you were in school with him, you say?
Yes, at college.
Oh, in college, okay.
In college, yeah. Not in seminary, though.
Okay.
All right. Well,
he didn't go to seminary at the same college campus area.
Right. Well, you nailed it.
Ted Strickland lost for.
Okay, great.
Ted Strickland.
Mary Lou, hold the line.
Okay.
Just to let you know, Ted Strickland lost 1976, 1978, 1980 for the House before he was elected in 1992. Then he lost for the fourth time in 1994, and then he was defeated for governor in 2010 for re-election. So that's five losses. So the Yankees are only three away from there.
Howard wants me to point out that on his pad here, he had Strickland written down, and below that, he had two guesses. Below that, he had Jim Rhodes.
Strickland first. I was pretty sure about Strickland.
Strickland was good. Kucinich was a very good guess, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Before the break, we were talking about the president being in Michigan yesterday about the minimum wage and the possibility the Senate could vote on that next week. There's also a possibility of a minimum wage constitutional amendment, I believe it was in Arkansas, which could make a difference in a tight Senate race there where an incumbent Democrat is facing a pretty strong challenge from a Republican. Could the Democrats in 2014 use some of those minimum wage ballot issues the same way that the Karl Rove and company used the constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage back in 2004?
Back when same-sex marriage was an unpopular opinion, now it's the majority opinion in the country. It's remarkable how fast same-sex marriage has moved, or President Obama would say evolved in this country. It is pretty remarkable. Sure, the Democrats are exactly doing that. They're fearful. You know, the Republicans need a net gain of six seats to win control of the Senate, and all these vulnerable Democrats in whether they're incumbents or states where they're retiring in West Virginia and South Dakota and Arkansas and Alaska and North Carolina and Louisiana, these are in Montana. These are all states, are red states, the states that Mitt Romney won in 2012. So Democrats are very nervous about losing the Senate. Six is a large number, but it's certainly doable, and the Obama numbers are pretty weak. So the Democrats are hoping that maybe if we focus on raising the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised in years, and which a majority of even Republicans say is overdue regarding pay equity between men and women, that is a popular opinion in this country. And of course, if the Republicans vote against it or block it, the Democrats could say that, you know, they're not really family friendly the way we are. Ultimately, though, regarding minimum wage, the president is going, you know, around the country talking about it. I noticed that a lot of states are implementing it on their own, and that may be the way it's going to change. But the guess is they're going to put it on the floor to raise it to $10.10. It's going to get defeated, and then there is a bipartisan group led. One of the people leading it is Susan Collins, the Republican from Maine, who said, "Oh, look, $10.10 is pretty dramatic, but we owe the American people a raise in the minimum wage, and so maybe it'll be a much more modest increase." But I still think that it could very well happen in 2014.
And there are a whole lot of voters out there who had lost higher-paying jobs during the recession and ended up working these minimum wage jobs.
And right, and these minimum, and obviously, if you don't change that number in a couple of years, your income, when everything else is changing, right. You know, you're staying flat or losing out. But small business people, and I mean people who are short in height, but small business people will make the argument that, well, you know, the because if you're going to raise it to $10.10, we may not be able to afford to have that many full time workers at that amount. So that could hurt in the long run as well. That's the two arguments.
Did the Democrats breathe a sigh of relief this week when the deadline passed for folks to sign up for the Affordable Care Act and the open enrollment? The deadline was March the 31st, and on Monday even, there were folks saying they weren't going to reach their goal of 7 million. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday, we found out they exceeded their goal of 7 million. That's good for Democrats.
It's certainly good for the White House. I mean, it would have been terrible if the White House was talking about 6-7 million signups and then the number was far short of that. Ultimately, I don't know what it means. I think it is a bragging point. It's probably a deserved bragging point. But again, yes, we have 7.1 signups, and a lot of them are young people, which is of course what the White House wanted. And I think a lot of them signed up at the last second because that's what young people do. They make decisions at the last second at deadline. But it still doesn't change the fact that premiums are likely to rise pretty heavily in 2015. I think both sides are acknowledging that. Not everybody is still able to have the health care plan that they wanted, or at least the one they had before. So the Republicans still are looking at numbers that show that there's still dissatisfaction with the plan in the country, in the polls, and they're running on that. But many Democrats are saying, yes, there are problems, and it's not just about the website, but we're not going to repeal it. We're going to fix it and change it. And I think a majority of the American people feel that's the course that should be taken.
The NPR poll, the just came out, that your friend and ours, Mara Liasson, reported on, showed that 47% said that they approved of Obamacare, 51% said no. And Mara's conclusion from this was that while it's still unpopular, it may not be as heavy a millstone for Democrats as expected. Would you agree with that assessment?
I'm not sure. Of course, this is April, and we're not talking about late October when voters are really thinking about this. But we did see something in the last couple of weeks. We saw the result of a House election in Florida and a special election that the Democrats thought they would win. And Republicans are convinced that by running against so-called Obamacare, that's what made the difference. And the Democrats were really nervous about that. And if you look at Democratic campaign ads around the country, in my podcast this week, I talk about Ann Kirkpatrick, a thought to be vulnerable Democrat in Arizona, who says, you know, it was atrocious, the beginning of it. And there were so many things that were not working well, but I want to fix it. So I think the Democratic strategy is let's criticize as much as we can, but let's not get rid of it, because things like pre-existing conditions and all these things that didn't exist before are very, very important and very, very popular. I think the Democrats are nervous about it. They're clearly nervous about it. And, you know, that combined with a low 40% approval rating of President Obama in a sixth year of his presidency is just, you know, just nerve-wracking for the Democrats.
But they can take a little of the edge off of this by making this argument, okay, let's, you know, it's not perfect, but let's try to fix it.
Well, sure. And I think, Democrats have been saying that for quite a while, although in the beginning, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's the chairperson of the DNC, and Nancy Pelosi and President Obama said, we don't need to fix anything because everything is working hunky-dory. And obviously it's not. I don't know if what we're hearing from the White House right now is just spin or hoping for the best. Certainly they're hoping for the best. But right now, I still think it's too early to conclude that the Democrats are over the hump about the Affordable Care Act.
You mentioned, I think, earlier in the program where we were talking about the House, there are efforts to do something to repeal Obamacare. And I pulled something off the AP that, as a matter of fact, today that they were the headline, House Republicans are launching a new attack on the president's health care law just days after the law beat expectations by signing up 7 million Americans. Apparently, they're scheduled to vote today to change the law's definition of full-time work from 30 hours a week to 40 hours a week, and that would mean fewer workers would be able to get employer-sponsored health care coverage. Are we going to continue to see these votes almost weekly from House Republicans? Is there counter-effort to Obamacare that to show their constituents, you know, if they're in districts where you don't like it, that we're trying to do something about it? Have we lost Ken again?
Well, you know something, that's the real question here is, are they trying to really change the law? And of course, they would love to change the law, but appealing to their base. Are they trying to remind their base that we promised to repeal Obamacare? Of course, they never were going to, with a Democratic Senate and a Democrat in the White House, a guy named President Obamacare. I think that's his name, so it's not going to happen. But the Republicans promised their base, we're going to do everything we can to stop it. And so will they succeed? Of course not. But I think they want to remind people that if you give us the Senate in 2014, which is still a possibility, things can very well change regarding the way the law is written. But really, a lot of it is appealing to the base and less so about really repealing the law.
If the Senate were to change to GOP control come January, Obamacare is not something that can be unwound overnight, correct?
Correct. And of course, whatever they want to do, you know, you still have a presidential veto there. But the Republicans saying that right now they have one third of the government. They have the House, whereas the Senate and the White House is Democratic control. Some smart guys, some wise guys might say that they have half because they have the Supreme Court. But that's another argument altogether. But they feel that if they can have the Senate and the House, then they can have a united front and they could be more have a better opportunity to make the case that this is exactly what we want to do. The Congress, the House and Senate would be on the same page, and then it would be the Congress versus the White House. Whereas right now, the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans have been spending so much time battling each other. They really would love to have Republican control of the Senate. And again, as Nate Silver says, and of course, if Nate Silver says it, it must be true,
yes,
that the Republicans have a good shot at winning that. And of course, that's really what the goal is. I mean, who knows if Mitch McConnell will survive his campaign or not, but one way or the other, the Republicans want to get a majority.
And that's the message that they're going to take to these red states that they think they can pull off.
Oh, there's no question. Exactly right. I said, look, we have an opportunity to control the Congress. We haven't been doing it well. We haven't been doing it since. I mean, we tried to do it in 2010, and all we got was the House. In 2010 and 2012, the Republicans thought we would pick up more Senate seats, and that didn't happen. But if they can do it in 2014, and, you know, it's certainly doable. Of course, you know, we thought the Republicans would make great gains after 6 years of Bill Clinton in 1998, but they so overreached, Newt Gingrich and company so overreached with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, things like that, that the voters said, wait a second, you're going in the wrong direction. And the Democrats picked up seats in 1998, which is the historical aberration in a six-year presidency. Right now, the guess is the Republicans do certainly pick up seats in the Senate, at least three for right now, perhaps four or five, and they pick up maybe a handful in the House. The question, of course, is not so much whether they can keep control of the House, which I think they do, but whether they have enough to take the Senate as well.
We are talking with political junkie Ken Rudin. If you have a question, 513-419-7100. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan released his budget proposal this week. Morning Edition had a tagline that there was something in there for conservative Republicans to love and for Democrats to pick up on as campaign themes. What do you make of his budget proposal?
Well, I think what you just said is exactly right. I think both sides feel they have an advantage of it. Paul Ryan, everybody's talking about Paul Ryan as a possible presidential candidate in 2016, but with the chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee coming open, Dave Camp of Michigan, who's retiring, but he's term limited anyway, I think Paul Ryan really wants to be Ways and Means Committee chairman. This is his opportunity to put his signature on an issue that's affecting the budget process, of everything about things that need to be done about all these the expenses of the entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare and things like that. At the same time, calling for tax cuts for the wealthy. And of course, whenever you hear Republicans calling for tax cuts for the wealthy, the Democrats think they have an issue. And so Dick Durbin of Illinois, the senator who's the number two Senate Democrat, said this is the greatest thing that, you know, we can hope for. The fact is, once again, the Republicans in the House are pushing for tax cuts for the wealthy. And President Obama, when he was campaigning, appearing yesterday in Michigan, he called it a stink burger. I mean, of course, he was at a deli when he said that. But I mean, so the Republicans feel they have an issue. The Democrats feel they have an issue in the Ryan budget.
And while he put this out there, is it like most things in Washington right now? It's probably not going anywhere. It's just out there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that'll never pass the Senate. It certainly could easily pass the House. But we're talking about, cutting $5 trillion in federal spending and we're cutting food stamps. Now, we just had an agreement. The Republicans, Democrats, House and Senate just came up with agreement on food stamps. But this is far more cuts in food stamps than the Democrats agreed to before. Obviously, more bad news for the poor and the working class. And once again, it's another repeal of Obamacare. So this is, again, what the Republican base wants to hear. And if you're a Democrat running on the defensive, maybe Democrats want to hear it as well, because they think they can counter it with a different kind of argument.
Today is our regular monthly chat with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we will continue our conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Political junkie Ken Rudin is joining us today, as he does once a month, to talk politics. You can join the conversation, too. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Ken, both houses have been working on an aid package for Ukraine. How much will the Ukrainian situation play into our elections here in November? Or is it an issue that is out there, but the voters in our country maybe not?
Well, something that is a good question. It may tie into the Republican narrative that President Obama is a weak leader. We always talked about who lost Korea. That was the big issue in the 1952 election. Maybe we can say who lost Crimea. But I don't think voters. They watched what the Russians did with Crimea, and of course I keep saying the Soviet troops. It just feels like the Soviet Union, but there are Russian troops on the border of eastern Ukraine that are perhaps maybe looking at another incursion into the country. But ultimately, elections are about domestic issues. It's the economy, stupid, as James Carville famously said. Two, if it is about foreign policy, it's American people are involved. So when you had Americans dying in Iraq, in the aftermath of the invasion there, it became a big issue in 2006 and 2008. I think the reason Barack Obama became the Democratic nominee for president and not Hillary Clinton is because Clinton voted to give President Bush the authority to go to war. And Obama, who was a state senator at the time, said, was a U.S. senator at the time, no, a state senator at the time, who said that this is just insane. So I think it can play an effect, but it's not like the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, which is 90 miles away from our shore. There was a lot of people upset about what happened in Crimea, just as it was when the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia in 68 and Hungary in 56. But ultimately, as a campaign issue, I think maybe not so much. But again, if the Republicans could say this is part of Obama's weakness and his falling standing in the world, then maybe the Republicans could get some stuff out of it. They're still battling over Benghazi, and by most accounts, American people are not paying attention to that.
But aren't most Democrats running for the House and Senate, or a lot of them anyway, at a point where they can pretty much cut this president loose? He's a lame duck president. They can start building some distance between themselves and him on these kind of issues. Obviously, the incumbents can't cover up their, you know, their voting records. But can't they put some distance between themselves and Obama now? Is it safe?
Yes, yes, they can. Yes, they can, and but that is a risk because, one, ultimately, within the Democratic Party, President Obama is still very, very popular.
Yeah.
He can raise a ton of money. You don't want to invite him into Arkansas, for example, or Louisiana to campaign for you. But, of course, right. if Obama has a fundraiser for you, a fundraiser for the party, and you can get some of the proceeds, believe me, you'll take it for what it's worth. You'll take it as much as you can. But that we, you know, we have seen Democrats not be afraid to break from the president. We saw the Democrats very upset with any kind of trade deals that President Obama is proposing. We saw Democrats very willing to break from the president on his suggestion once upon a time that we get involved militarily in Syria. And Democrats said, no, 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 we're so war weary. It's not going to happen. So, and also on Obamacare, we see, again, campaign ads around the country. They're not specifically criticizing Obama, but they're certainly distancing themselves from him. And again, as I said over and over again, if you only have 40% approval ratings, that's probably smart politics.
Well, there was there's an old story from LBJ in 66 where he called in all the Democratic candidates, you know, for the House and Senate and said, look, boys, I got a great big plane. And if you want me to land that plane in your district, I will. If you want me to keep flying over, I'll do that. And that is that the kind of philosophy that Obama will take?
Absolutely. I mean, Obama will campaign wherever he's asked, but he may not be asked in that many tough races. Again, in those six or seven Senate races that everybody's watching, they're in red states. Now, look at 1986. Ronald Reagan was much more popular than Lyndon Johnson in 66 or Barack Obama in 2014. Mm-hmm. Reagan was at least 20 points more popular then, and yet the Republicans still lost the Senate. So ultimately, it's very possible that there's very little what a president can do for or against your candidate. But again, the Democrats are looking at polls as the Republicans are, and right now they don't like what they see.
I think the last time I looked, and there may have been others since the last time I looked a couple weeks ago, but I think primaries to date, there had been the one in Texas and one in Illinois. Is there any takeaways from those early primaries for you?
Not in Illinois, because the big story there was the race for a governor, and a very moderate Republican barely won the Republican primary there. And matter of fact, this is somebody who has given money to Obama in the past and Democrats. But you have a very unpopular governor there, Pat Quinn, so the Republicans would love to pick that up. Texas is a little interesting because the Tea Party made a big deal of challenging John Cornyn, the senator, in the primary, thinking he's not conservative enough, and the guy they put up there was a congressman, Steve Stockman, who got clobbered by John Cornyn and the establishment. But at the same time, the Tea Party also went after the lieutenant governor in Texas, David Dewhurst, and while they didn't beat him yet because there's a May runoff, it looks like they're going to beat him. So every time we write the obituary of the Tea Party, I always still think it's very premature. You do have some primaries coming up that Republicans are nervous about, especially in Mississippi with Thad Cochran, who's been around for a long time, since 1979, and he has a tough primary. You know, again, as Karl Rove and many so-called establishment Republicans say, that we could win this Senate, we could capture the Senate, but not if we're eating each other alive in the primaries. And you tell a Tea Party person, then they say, well, look, the answer is not victory, not the answer is not winning, it's staying true to your principles. And that's a division you're going to see not only in 2014 in the Republican Party, but in 2016 as well, especially in the race for president.
This may be a question for Kim, but it may also be a question for Howard. I was driving yesterday and had on a major AM radio station,
yes,
which in Cincinnati.
I think I know what you're going to say.
I heard House Speaker John Boehner running a radio ad, and I was a little surprised that he was running an ad prior to the Ohio primary.
I have not heard John Boehner do an ad in many, many years, and he has four Republicans on the ballot running against him, and mostly Tea Party folks. And it was interesting because it was an anti-Obama message, anti-Obamacare, I'm fighting against, you know. I mean, do you find that interesting, Ken? I mean, that he would go out of his way. I mean, this is a very Republican district. I mean, he's going to win, obviously.
I'm very surprised that this is the first time I'm hearing of it. Of course, the question is not whether it's a Republican district or not. It's a question is whether how Republican it is.
Right.
It. And we know that the Tea Party and John Boehner are not the best of friends. John Boehner has pointedly criticized the Tea Party tactics in the last couple of months, which he didn't do in the last 2 years. So that is instructive. I don't think he's nervous about a primary. I haven't read about anything like that, but I agree with you. I think it's very, very interesting that he's going on the airwaves. Maybe when you have so much money, you need to spend it in some way.
Well,
but, you know, for John,
I mean, I could see him being embarrassed by, you know, if these opponents, you know, put together some kind of, you know, fairly large number of votes. I mean, they're not going to win, but it could be embarrassing for him.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that the John Boehner's problems with the Tea Party is more Washington-based than Ohio-based, and I suspect that it's not going to be much of a close primary. But, you know, you can't be too sure. Dick Lugar in Indiana probably thought he'd have a cakewalk for a renomination, and he lost to Richard Murdoch in that primary. So, of course, there are different circumstances there, but you can't be too careful. You can't be too careful and let somebody sneak up on you from behind or from the right.
The one other thing about Boehner, I mean, besides, there are a lot of Tea Party people in that district who aren't very happy with him, but one of the things that if you travel in that district, you pick up from a lot of people is, well, yeah, he's Speaker of the House, but he really doesn't pay any attention to us. You know, and do anything for the district. That's always been the rap on John Boehner. Obviously, it hasn't impacted his ability to get elected yet, but it's out there.
That's a good point, and of course, that is exactly what cost Tom Foley his seat in 1994 when he basically sued his own voters on term limits and really spent more time in Washington. So you always have to look at home as well. But the fact is, I mean, John Boehner, as far as I know, is the first person of color to be Speaker of the House in history. And I think that is worth something to you know.
On Monday, the WBUR NPR program Here and Now had a reporter on who had done a report.
Is that the show that replaced Talk of the Nation? I can't remember. Oh, I'm sorry.
You went there, not me.
Sorry.
But there was a new report from Associated Press. Republicans spent years developing a strategy to take advantage of the 2010 census, taking control of state legislatures and drawing congressional districts that favored the GOP. I guess I was kind of curious. How is that a new report? How could that be something new? Hasn't that been well known since prior to 2010 even?
Is that the show that replaced Talk of the Nation? No. Well, look, I think it's just reminding. I mean, I don't know the purpose of it because, of course, it's old news, and the Democrats have been complaining about that. You know, from the once that census numbers went into reapportionment, but. The point is, everybody talks about the battle for control of the Senate and the battle for control of the House. State legislatures are crucial. One of the reasons that Ohio Republicans did so well in the 2012 congressional elections is that they have a Republican governor and they have a Republican state legislature. One of the reasons that North Carolina Republicans are doing so well is because they have a Republican governor and a state legislature, even though voters in North Carolina voted for Democratic House candidates far more than they did for Republican. But the way the lines were drawn, it helps the Republican Party. In Illinois, the Democrats have a Democratic governor and a Democratic state legislature, and the Republican Party paid the price. My only point is, I mean, I'm not sure what the purpose of an AP story this late in the cycle is, but it reminds people that there's so much more at stake in elections than just the races that the national media focus on.
But you're still looking at 2016, and you're looking at an electoral college map that favors the Democrats, correct?
Well, the funny thing is, for the longest time, we kept talking about how the electoral college favored Republicans. There was a streak there where the Republicans had won 5 out of 6 elections, presidential elections, that ended with Bill Clinton in 1992. But for the longest time, we always said it favors the Republicans. Now I think it does favor the Democrats because aside from Texas, what big state is leaning Republican anymore? It's not New York. It's not California. That's never going to vote for Republican, or at least not in the next couple of cycles. And then you have states that are supposedly on the fence, like Pennsylvania, Michigan. Look at Ohio. Look at Florida. They went Democratic. So, you know, Republicans once had a certain lock on a certain states. Florida, Ohio, Virginia, North Carolina, but they don't have that anymore. Right now, all they can be assured of is Texas, and with major demographic changes happening in the Lone Star State, we don't know how long they'll have Texas either.
So, I mean, this would say to me that the Republicans are going to have to be very careful about whom they choose as their nominee in 2016.
That's the battle. The battle is, you want somebody, as the establishment would ask you, do you want somebody who could win? And that's the argument for, like, Jeb Bush, for example. Or do you want somebody who's true to your principles? And there are a lot of people who are looking at Rand Paul and say, this is a different kind of Republican. He appeals to the young. He appeals to, you know, the anti-war constituency, both of which are in Democratic corner. But Republicans are scared to death of Rand Paul, the so-called isolationism, the go-it-alone foreign policy. And he has said some interesting things, shall we say, in the past about the 1964 Civil Rights Act and things like that. So we could talk about, yes, the Republicans are old giddy about 2014, and maybe many Tea Party and conservatives are excited about 2016 with Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, whoever, but the Republicans who are in the leadership of the party and the establishment are very, very nervous. I say that, you know, once again, we can get somebody who's on paper theoretically winnable, as Mitt Romney was thought to be in 2012. But the process just eats you up when you have these debates and these caucuses where the very conservative element of the party comes out. And if you're espousing something about immigration reform, you're suddenly being branded as, you know, somebody for amnesty. And that's what the Republican Party is facing. They can have a great 2014 while at the same time have a miserable 2016.
You were talking about GOP contenders, and you actually, in honor of March Madness, had a bracket for GOP contenders, and you're down to your final four.
Well, actually, Saturday night is the deadline for the final four. The last four contests are Rand Paul, who, as you well know, beat Michelle Bachmann and Jeb Bush, against John Thune, the senator from South Dakota, who's beaten Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum. That's one contest. Then you have Ted Cruz, who beat Cory Gardner and John Huntsman, against Chris Christie, who beat Sarah Palin and Mike Huckabee. In battle number three, Scott Walker, who beat Donald Trump, who I always thought was going to be the heir apparent for the Republican Party, and he beat Bobby Jindal. And then Rob Portman is still in the top eight. Rob Portman beat George P. Bush and Rick Perry. The final one is Paul Ryan, who beat Scott Brown and Mike Pence and Ajit Dement, and then Marco Rubio. So it's Rand Paul, John Thune, Ted Cruz, Chris Christie, Scott Walker, Rob Portman, Paul Ryan, and Marco Rubio. And we'll get the final four on Saturday night. If you go to my website at krpoliticaljunkie.com, you can play the game.
Wow.
You've worked in some one-liners there about heir apparent. Are you also trying to launch a new stand-up comedy career?
You're saying there's a difference between being on Cincinnati Edition and doing stand-up comedy? Come on, guys.
Hey, real quick here before we're down to just about a half minute here. There's a new, from my producer, there's a new Quinnipiac poll that shows Elizabeth Warren just ahead of Hillary Clinton. Do you expect that Elizabeth Warren may consider a run in 2016?
No, although there are a lot of progressives who would love that to see that happen. She says, I'm not ready for it yet. It's not going to happen. I can't imagine anybody with a serious challenge of Hillary Clinton. But there is hidden dissatisfaction with progressives of the party about positions that Hillary has taken, Obama's taken. And we'll see if that boils out into the open.
We've been talking with political junkie Ken Rudin about politics, and you'll find links to his podcast and his website. Those are on our website, WVXU.org. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
I'll see you in the Catskills.
Okay.
And thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Bruce Ellis. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.